Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it is my pleasure to welcome you to today's program. We are heading into the end of the current season, so I just want to remind you the next 2 weeks, the programs that we have set up for you. Next week we'll have Dr. Reuben Cohort of the Syracuse Community Health Center, and the following week Mayor Stephanie Miner will be talking about the city budget and some other issues. So come prepared with your questions on those two issues. Also, you will be receiving very soon, if you haven't already, an invitation to the Onondaga Citizens League annual meeting. That happens on June 8th at the zoo. And you can put in your reservation registration anytime now. We will be honoring 40 Below with our Civic Education Award. We'll also be honoring Kathy Goldfarb-Findling, who retired from the Gifford Foundation, for her efforts in leading the Gifford Foundation's civic engagement activities. And David Holder of the Syracuse Convention and Visitors Bureau will be our guest speaker, talking about community image issues. So that's that. Right now, it is my pleasure to introduce TMR member Fred Fisk of the Vera House Board, who will be doing this morning's introduction. Thank you, Fred.
I was looking for my high heels this morning, and I could not locate them. You know, we do an annual walk. I am a volunteer at Vera House and co-chair of Vera House's White Ribbon campaign this year. And a couple weeks ago on Friday, we did our walk a mile in her shoes walk from Clinton Square to Armory Square. And some of us guys put on high heels to symbolize our empathy with women, and particularly women who face domestic abuse, and also to represent our commitment never to tolerate or commit violence against women in word or deed. But somehow the shoes disappear, sort of like Cinderella's slipper, after every march, and then they magically reappear the next year. So I spare you that ordeal of looking at me hobbling up here in high heels. But I can report that this year's White Ribbon campaign, which recently concluded, it went quite well, and the contributions are coming in quite nicely, according to Chris Benton, our White Ribbon coordinator at Vera House. And she said, in particular, the participation of our honorary chair this year, David Smith, Dr. David Smith from upstate, has galvanized the medical community such that our distribution of ribbons just within upstate and St. Joe's and Krause alone has more than quintupled, I think you'd say, gone from 1,200 ribbons to about 6,700 ribbons. So that's great news. My task here is to introduce Randy Bregman, Executive Director of Vera House, and a very modest person who wants me to be very brief. So with her indulgence, I'll just say a few words about Randy, and then we'll get the program going, where we're talking not about the White Ribbon Campaign so much as about what the White Ribbon Campaign is trying to get the message out about, which is domestic violence. Randy started at Vera House 21 years ago. And from her resume, it looks like that's when her life began, actually. I had to pry more details out of her, like the fact that she was born and raised in this area, in Syracuse, and raised in DeWitt, and went to SUNY Albany for her education in political science, and worked for a while in the legislature, including for Pete Grannis, a former DEC commissioner now, and was in the was in the state assembly. Started, as I say, at Vera House in 1990. And Vera House is a place where the staff, like Randy, does everything, which makes it very easy for volunteers like me. And so if anyone ever asks you to volunteer for Vera House, say yes right away, because it's the staff makes it really easy. Here's an example. I mean, here's what Randy does at Vera House. Well, first of all, she helped manage the merger between Vera House and the Rape Crisis Center in 2005, but that was later on. But as head of Vera House, she is responsible for administration, financial management, supervision of staff, fundraising, fund development, community education, professional training, and program development. She co-chairs the Area Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition, chairs the Human Services Leadership Council of Central New York, is on the State Advisory Council for the Office of Victim Services and the State Coalition Against Sexual Assault Policy, and on the board of the Food Bank. She co-facilitates support groups for women who experience abuse, provides case management, counseling, and advocacy at various times. And once a month, she sits in and does a shift answering Vera House's 24-hour domestic violence sexual assault hotline. In her spare time, she doesn't have any spare time. But she does have a family. Her husband, Ted, works in IT at Krauss. Her daughter, Sonia, graduated from SU Social Work Program, as did Randy, and is a program coordinator at Catholic Services, the third generation of social workers in her family, because Randy's mother was a social worker who graduated in SU's first social work class. Son Carl is a sophomore at NYU, majoring at the School of Education. I had to pry out of her information about some awards. She has the Post Standard Person of Achievement Award, District Attorney's Advisory Council, Advisory Council Award, and the paragraph goes on and on. But I'll keep it short, Randy. I asked her what her favorite color was as a joke. I said I was just kidding, but I didn't say the answer would be off the record. And she answered, pink. Sorry, Randy. That's my daughter, 12-year-old daughter's favorite color, too. Great color. She's one of my heroes. She is a key holder of our safety net in this community. Please welcome Randy Bregman.
I want to thank Fred for the kind introduction, probably shorter than he wanted, but much longer than I wanted or needed. And I want to also thank all of you for coming out today and for the leadership that you show in this community. I know everybody in this room has had a variety of either public or private community leadership roles. Many of you I've had the privilege of meeting or knowing in a number of different contexts in my life, and I'm really pleased and honored to be here today and appreciate the invitation. Of course, we were supposed to be here at Fred's suggestion the day before our White Ribbon campaign kicked off, perfect timing, but somehow the New York State Attorney General had an opportunity to come to town, and we thought it made a lot more sense for you all to have the privilege to hear our state's Attorney General rather than us. And so we're shifting our focus a little bit today, although I did bring some white ribbons. Our campaign officially ended at the start of the month, but many people wear their white ribbon pin throughout the year. Chauncey will be talking with you a bit about what that means throughout the year, particularly for men in our community to take a leadership role in efforts to end domestic and sexual violence. And we're really gathered today to talk a little bit about Vera House, a little bit about our campaign, and a lot about how each of us can make a difference in ending domestic and sexual violence in our community. A few people had warned me, sometimes there's hard questions at TMR. But like Fred said, I've been here in this work almost 21 years. I've trained veteran police officers, and so I've kind of steeled myself for the questions that may come. But I have to say the first question I got over at the table over here was the question of, well, why are you still there? People in executive director roles stay too long. And it's a good, fair question, and it does limit the opportunity for leadership development in our nonprofit community, so I accept it, and it's fair. But I will tell you that the reason that I'm still here is because I don't know if any of you have had the experience in your life of feeling a calling to the work you do. And for me, when I first went to Vera House, as Fred said in my introduction, I started as a legislative director in the New York State Assembly. My mother was a social worker. I wanted to change the world. And so I got out in the big world, and I found out it's kind of hard to change the big world from the legislature. And I wanted to feel like I could make a little bit of a difference. I went to social work school, not sure where I would end up. I answered an ad in the paper and started at Vera House, not because I was called to do domestic violence work or not because I knew that that's what I always wanted to do, because I wanted to find a job. And I started there, and with a few months, I realized this is where I am supposed to be. And so I'm sorry I may be in the way for other people who are supposed to be able to move into this role. But one of the things our outstanding chair of this year's campaign, Dr. David Smith, talked about when he spoke a few times throughout the campaign with the message that he was bringing about why he was involved, is how often statistics are numbers that wash away the tears. And I think I have a privilege of standing before you this morning after spending a very long night last night. This happens to be, for those of you who don't know, Sexual Assault Awareness Month, Child Abuse Awareness Month, and National Crime Victims Rights Week. So last night, for the first time in the years I've been at Vera House, I attended both the Crime Victims Vigil at 5 o'clock at the Cathedral, and then went up to Syracuse University for the Take Back the Night March, followed by a speak out. So we had the opportunity to hear the stories behind the statistics, to remember the tears, to hear and see the survivors of loved ones who have lost their lives through violence and have not had the opportunity to fully heal but come together in community to try and find steps toward healing. And then to hear young people, largely women, a few young men, most of them between the ages of 18 and 22, tell their stories of sexual assault, witnessing domestic violence when they were 6 or 8 or 10 years old, and the impact it has on them today, to tell their stories of acquaintance rape, sexual assault on the Syracuse University campus. And so when we talk a little bit about Vera House services and what we're here to do, I know that our most fundamental role, and Chauncey will speak to this a bit too, we often talk about, and Kate Flannery, who I had the privilege of serving as co-directors with when Rape Crisis Center and Vera House first merged, she used to always say that we spend a lot of time in the work we do in Rape Crisis and Vera House pulling people out of the river, which is what we do. But what we're inviting all of you to be part of, what the White Ribbon Campaign is about, is working together to try and catch people before they fall into the river, to try and create a community standard that doesn't tolerate the underpinnings of domestic and sexual violence. And that's really what we hope will be part of here today with all of you. So I prepared a brief presentation just to give you a sense, for those of you who may not know, all of the programs and services of Vera House. And then I'm going to transition, let Chauncey talk a little bit about how we invite you all to be part of a community solution. So this gives you a little sense that Vera House is now a comprehensive domestic and sexual violence service agency. Many people think of Vera House as a shelter. If you ask somebody what's Vera House, they'll say, I think it's a shelter for battered women. That is the essence from which we were born, but we have grown to recognize the many different ways that people's lives are touched and the services they may need other than simply emergency shelter. Our history began for Vera House in 1977 when a dedicated and passionate woman, Sister Mary Vera Blank, saw the victims coming into St. Lucie's Church with nowhere to go in our community. And she courageously, with her vision, built what became Vera House in 1977. In 1974, Rape Crisis Center, similar group of community volunteers who said there's a problem in our community and we need to have a response. Kate and I both came into our respective roles as leaders of those organizations in the summer of 2001, and a number of people said to us, you two have to get together, you should talk. And it was a great honor and privilege to sit down and talk about possibly coming together in a variety of ways, not because either of us was in financial trouble, not because we couldn't survive, but because we believed that by coming together, we could better serve the vulnerable victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, so that now, instead of having to call from Vera House to figure out how to get somebody referred into Rape Crisis, we can literally have somebody receiving service from an advocate, realize they have a sexual assault trauma, walk them down the hall, and have them meet their potential therapist face-to-face. And merger is not easy. Merger does not come without challenge. But Kate and I had a mantra throughout that process, mission and service. We're doing this for mission and service. So all of the hurdles we found, we would try and step over them through a belief that we could better serve our community. And I'm very proud of the opportunity to have done that with Kate Flannery. January 1st, we were able to officially merge. It took us until November of that year to find space where we could live together in one of the many challenges that came along the way. But we're thrilled to be in one space other than where our shelters are located. So we provide a number of different services beyond shelter. Our shelter typically houses about 400 people a year. Something that people are not aware of is, as of a couple of years ago, we do shelter men and their families in crisis due to domestic violence. As our community has had a tremendous impact of the economic situation, and we found more and more people needing shelter in our community, not enough shelter beds, Vera House was licensed to provide shelter for people in crisis, but we've really focused all of our sheltering on people who specifically need to flee violent situations, need the confidential location of our shelter, and that does sometimes include men and men with their children. We shelter people who identify as straight, who identify as gay, who identify as transgender, and we work very hard to make sure our services are accessible in every way possible. We provide the rape, crisis, and sexual assault services. So some of that is through our 24-hour hotlines. One of the first things Kate and I talked about when merger came up was this opportunity. They had to pay people to carry cell phones to answer the hotline. We have a 24-hour shelter that's staffed so that we now have all of those hotlines coming into our landline at the shelter where we're able to respond to people 24 hours a day. We also go out and respond to them at the hospitals, at police stations, wherever they may be. And we provide therapeutic services to typically about 700 individuals a year, women, men, and children. About half of the people we serve are children who've been sexually assaulted by somebody they're supposed to be able to know and trust. So that's our youth counseling program. We also are able to provide service to children who've witnessed domestic violence in that program, not only those who've been sexually assaulted. Our outreach and advocacy services, again, all of our services are accessible through our 24-hour hotline. We provide individual short-term counseling. We do weekly support groups. We have a domestic violence and sexual assault education group. We offer those both at our offices. We work in partnership with McMahon Ryan very closely and offer services at their location as well. And we're working with a church in the northwestern part of the county now to provide a group up there as well. So we try and bring the service where the people are in need. And we serve about 1,000 people. This year we're just running our statistics, over 1,000 people in our advocacy program. Our education program, a lot of our work is with young people in the schools. We do second and fourth grade. We do middle school. We do high school. We talk about bullying. We talk about your right to safety, your body being private. We talk about healthy relationships. We have a mentors and violence program that tries to help young people become leaders and empowered bystanders. Some of the messages we'll be talking about today, and Chauncey's worked a lot with that program. And we also do community education, where we come together and talk with groups like this about how we can make a difference together in our community. Altogether, we typically reach somewhere between 17,000, 18,000 people in a typical year. And I mentioned the youth education program, and critically important, I think, recently is that peer leadership component, where we train youth to talk with other youth about these issues, because their voices are always going to be heard very differently than ours. The Syracuse Area Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition, where I started at Vera House in 1990, and Lucia was chair of the Justice Committee for 150 years while we were there together, I think. Many of you have been partnered. Judge Hanusek, sometimes I think he was at the Justice Committee this week. And that's an opportunity to bring people together in the community who care about these issues to try and create a coordinated, comprehensive response across the community of victim safety and offender accountability. Our ECHO program works with young people who are caught up in the probation system, are at risk of being placed at the cost of $150,000, $200,000, $300,000 a year. We try to provide intensive home-based services. Many of them have experienced sexual assault, sexual abuse in their lives, and that's one of the barriers to their moving forward to have a healthy, safe environment for them. Our alternatives program is a 26-session educational program for men who've been abusive to their female partners. Most of the people in that program are mandated through the court system, many through Judge Hanusek's court, some through Judge Doherty's domestic violence court, through probation, parole, and others in the community. We do accept those who volunteer to come to the program. It's just not that high a percentage of those who end up coming in. We have a very active volunteering program without which we could not accomplish what we do. Fred talked about how little volunteers do. I think that's a bit of an understatement for him and for the others who volunteer. We have a family court assistance office down near Judge Hanusek where Somebody can come in anytime that court is open and have help filling out the paperwork to get an order of protection. That is completely staffed by volunteers, two shifts a day, 5 days a week. Sometimes we have law students who come in who help provide backup so someone can actually go into court with the person who's filled out a petition. We have volunteers answering our 24-hour hotline. It's volunteers who respond to the hospital other than daytime hours. So every night, midnight to 8 a.m., 5 p.m. to 12 midnight, and all over the weekend, it's volunteers who get up with a phone call and hear there's a sexual assault victim in the hospital that needs someone there, and within 30 minutes we are there, and it's a volunteer who's called first. So I think it might be an understatement if you sign on to volunteer and you say, wait, Fred said I could just say I'm a Vera House volunteer. But if you have time, energy, and spirit to give, there's always a place at Vera House. We believe very strongly in the role of our volunteers. A little bit of our income sources. We, like many agencies in the community, are challenged because we rely a great deal on government funding. It's typically around 65 or 70% of our funding, and that includes federal, state, and county funds. And these last few years have been very hard, particularly on the state and county front, for many of our sister and brother agencies as well. So then we're all trying to further develop our private dollar base, but that's a little bit hard in a community that's been economically hit. But we are blessed with a lot of very generous donors who give in different ways, from a $10 check to somebody who walks in with a $1,000 check and says, 10 years ago, you saved my life or my daughter's life. And we're blessed with people who give and very thankful that we have a little bit of a diverse funding base. This gives you a sense of our largest programs, our emergency shelter, because we're 24-hour staffed and we provide very intensive services there. Is a very large proportion of our budget, as is our counseling and advocacy program, where the core of our direct service work is done. And before we take questions, we'll leave that up, I'm going to welcome and introduce my colleague and friend, the Reverend Chauncey Brown, who serves with Vera House as our men's outreach coordinator and also as pastor at True Vine Baptist Church. And because I believe in short introductions, I didn't get all the information that Fred made me send him via email. But I will tell you, Chauncey is a man whose spirit is rich and true. And by delivering the message that he does to men and women in our community, I can watch social change happen. I can watch people's eyes light up. And I think we're very blessed to have a man like Chauncey in our community. And I welcome him to share a little bit about his thoughts on all of this with you.
Thank you, Randy. And thank all of you again for allowing us to be here this morning. One of the things Randy said when she began to talk is about us, Vera House, being known as pulling people out of the river, or pulling women out of the river. And so that's kind of what I want to preface talking about to show you where we are. And know probably a lot of you, when you heard, is like, okay, what are we talking about? Just imagine that you're one nice day, you're sitting by the river, and as you're sitting out there, you see this woman coming, floating down the river, just screaming and crying for help. You pull her out of there. You stay there a little while longer, go back and continue to relax. Two women come floating down the river. You pull them out of there. And after a while, you see this trend continuing to happen. You wonder, what in the world is going on? And so you decide, instead of me continue to sit here and see these women come down the river and me pulling them out, maybe I need to go down the river and see who's throwing them in the river. So that way I can stop it there. And that's kind of where we are now. Vera House, as Randy said earlier, a lot of the work was doing the sheltering and helping pulling women out of the river. But now we're at another place where we need to no longer just pull them out of the river. Let's go down the river and find out who is the person or who is the blame for them being thrown in the river. And let's start doing some preventative services. And that's really what I find myself enjoying doing here working at Vera House. I've been there now part-time for about 8 months, I think, something like that. But been working with Vera House for 7-8 years as the chair for the Religious Task Force and also as a facilitator for the Men's Alternative Program. Prior to that, I did a lot of work working with young people in schools. And when Randy came to me, and if you ever have Randy to ask you to do something, you can't tell her no. So if you want to volunteer, just stay around, let Randy come and talk to you. You will be volunteering for us. But she called me and asked me about the opportunity to come and start working with Vera House full time. And as I begin to think about the work that I've been doing for so long with young people, of trying to help them have better lives, but recognizing some of the stuff that I was doing with them to help them get out of the situations they were in. They were going back to homes where they had abuse going on. They were going back to homes that were not holistic homes. And so when I got the opportunity to come and work here and start thinking about working particularly with men, about how they start looking at their children, how they start looking at their lives, how they can start looking at making changes, it was a natural fit for me to come in and start talking about, let's make a difference at the beginning. Let's start talking to people about their behavior. And so when we talk about even the White Ribbon Campaign, it started in Canada where a young man went on a college campus and decided for no reason that he wanted to just line all the women up in the cafeteria on one side of the room, all the men up on another side of the room, and kill 14 women on that day. And the men on that campus wanted to make sure they made a statement that all men are not like that. We're your allies. We're here for you. So they started wearing the white ribbons around campus and letting everybody know that everybody's not like that. We want to let you know that you have some allies. You have some people who are going to stand with you. And so the White Ribbon Campaign, and what I look at as us trying to make a difference in our community, is for men. And I know, you know, Randy's been doing the work for 21 years. A lot of other women have been doing the work for 21 years or longer, or however long they've been doing the work. But now it's time for us again to look at men who are going to make the difference. Because if it's going to stop, it's going to take men talking to their partners, talking to their friends, talking to their peers about, why do you say the things that you say? Why do you do the things that you do? And it's good, as Fred said earlier, for us to be able to stand up, and most of our men in here are able to say, you know, I'm a great man. I don't condone or I don't commit domestic violence. And it's good to be at the first step of saying, I don't do it. The second step is to say, I don't condone it. But let's take that third step and say, I'm not going to stand silent about it. If I hear a friend of mine saying something that's inappropriate, if I hear them treating somebody in a way that they should be treating them, that I'm going to be the one who's going to stand up and say, hey, you know, that's not the way we talk. Let's start talking about how we can make differences in our community. And that's where I think Syracuse is on the way to now, is us having men to stand up and say, we're not going to just stand aside and say, I'm a great guy, I don't do it, and, you know, I'm an upstanding citizen. But not only am I going to be an upstanding citizen, I'm not doing it. I'm going to be an upstanding citizen to make sure that anybody who I consider a friend of mine is not going to do the same thing. Because you can't be a friend of mine. You can't be a colleague of mine. You can't be a person that I'm frequently seen with and you're treating women in an abusive way. Because that's not the type of people I hang around. So we want to look at how we can continue as a community to start making a change, start making a difference, that we can stop waiting for people to come down the river and try to pull them out. But let's go down the river some and find out who's putting them in there. Let's start talking about how we can make some of those social changes, whether it's about what men say or what they do. And I know I'm saying men, and I know some people might be saying, okay, there are women who are abusive too. True. But the majority number that we see, again, are men. So let's talk about making those changes. And even with that, let's start talking about how we can just be good citizens to everyone. Be allies for everyone. How can we start making the changes that we need to see in our community? How can we start being the ones to say, you know what? What I'm seeing is not comfortable. For me to hear someone say something to Randy that's derogatory, even though I might feel like, well, they didn't say it to me and I don't want to get involved, it's still not what I think I should be doing. I need to be involved in it because I want to make sure that not only am I safe, but also that my neighbor's safe. I was yesterday spent quite a bit of my day doing some training on domestic violence. And as I was at one of the places at United Radio talking, a lady started sharing her story with me about her sister-in-law who was married to an abusive man, and how this man was going from partner to partner and just abusing. He would become a very abusive person. And every woman that he would get involved with, he would be very abusive to them in the relationship. And even after they end the relationship, he would continue to stalk them. And the only way that he would stop harassing that person was when he would find someone else. And so, whereas you might think, well, it's not me, it's not happening now, but understand that if that person doesn't stop here, they might not be with your daughter today, they might not be with you today, but tomorrow they can be. So how do we start talking about challenging those beliefs, challenging those behaviors, so that way we don't have to wait until the last minute to do it? And so that's really where, again, I look at the work that I do. I enjoy part of it. As Randy said earlier, what I do is two things. I work with the alternatives program. That's the men who are mandated to us by probation, parole, and the courts to come to our 26-week program, challenge those guys who've been mandated because of their behavior. But the other part that I do that I really enjoy is what we have is our 12-man model. And the 12-man model is about getting men like those of you who are sitting in this room now who have not been mandated, who have not been abusive to their partners, to say, you know what, I want to get the education, and I want to start talking to those who are in my sphere of influence. I want to start us having those conversations. All the time I hear people saying, you know, women are emotional creatures. I'm like, men are too. Watch us at a football game. Watch us at a basketball game. Watch us anywhere we are. We are emotional. But we've been given permission to show the emotion of excitement. We've given permission to show the emotion of anger. But we haven't sometimes been given the permission to show the emotion of hurt. So what we do is a lot of time bottle it up and don't have it. So what we do in the 12-man model is start talking about those emotions, giving our men a place where we can talk about it and giving permission that if something hurts you, to say, I'm hurt, to say that this doesn't feel well for me, other than jumping right to anger, other than jumping right to rage. Talk about, you know what was said was not comfortable for me. Because oftentimes, again, only time we want to talk about relationships is if it's great or if it's bad, and we're talking about it in a negative way, other than saying, you know what, I need some help with this. So that's really what the 12-man model is. I started out as one of the original 12 men myself, William Fitzpatrick, Dan Loengard, Tom Wolfe, Fred Fisk, and quite a few other men. And what we did was Daniel Hagee, all of us were kind of brought in to start doing this work, and we were commissioned to go out and get 11 other men of our friends to start having those conversations. And so now we're looking at how we can continue to do that across the community. Recently, as Randy said earlier, with our White Ribbon campaign this year, Upstate Medical Center has started their own 12-men program. Krause Hospital has started their own 12-men program. Yesterday, being at United Radio, they're in the process of getting their own 12-men program. So if there's anyone in here who works at a place, or even if, again, Thursday morning roundtable, want to get some men together and start having that, so we can start having those conversations about how we can make a difference in our community, I encourage you to be a part of this here conversation, how we, again, as men, can join hands and join arms with our women who are doing the work so we can stop domestic violence and sexual assault here in the Syracuse community. So, again, thank you. And are we ready for questions?
I've got one back here. Thank you.
Randy, you might be able to anticipate this one, but could you talk to the group a little bit about Vera House's involvement with elder abuse?
I had a feeling that that might be your question. I could pass to Jenny Hicks, who's both our development director and also our elder abuse educator, because she can't give that up, even though she's come into the role as development director recently. But we have, for many years, under initially the leadership of Marianne Corsonetti, had an elder abuse education program and an elder abuse committee as part of our domestic and sexual violence coalition. And actually, the elder abuse committee at this point is probably the most active, dynamic group within the coalition, because we have a number of individuals from Adult Protective, from Aging and Youth, from the community, from housing providers for seniors, coming together to look at the issues of elder abuse. I often think of the work we've done in our community around child abuse, sexual assault, partner violence, and domestic violence, and recognize that elder abuse in many ways is sort of the last frontier, the one we've attended to the least and the one that we have to attend to much more, particularly as we have an aging population. So you'll see I brought a little set of brochures out there, and we have a fairly new elder abuse brochure that talks a little bit about that information. We're hoping one day to have targeted services, advocates who are trained to work with the elderly, but we certainly can provide those services now. So a lot of our work has been education and conversation, and I think we're looking at some next stages in terms of how we address financial exploitation issues in the community. Coming up on June 15th, we will once again celebrate what is recognized as International Elder Abuse Awareness Day, and that will be an opportunity for us to hear from a survivor, see a film, educate ourselves. So hopefully through the Thursday Morning Roundtable Network, we can get that information out to you as well. And I think it's an important next frontier for all of us in this arena of family violence. Thanks for the question, Marianne.
Are there areas in your 20 years experience statistically where an area of violence or victims that has gotten better or are there areas that of violence or victims that has gotten worse in our community?
Those are really difficult questions to answer, and part of our challenge is, for example, when you have a well-publicized case, like most recently, the tragic death of Jenny Lynn Watson, our crisis line is flooded with calls. When Wendy Dirk was killed a couple of years ago, crisis line is flooded with calls. Does that mean the incidence is up, or does it mean that people's awareness and reporting increases because there's a sense of the potential outcome of these cases and a desire for help? Overall, in my experience, looking back 21 years, I believe we've come a long way in terms of even the conversation that Chauncey was just having with you. There was no place in our conversation in 1990 when I came to Vera House about engaging men at this level of conversation. And I see that difference. I see the community conversation has shifted. I think our awareness of different groups of victims, so that, for example, international victims, migrants, refugees who come into the community who may not have legal status. And we've attempted, as we respond to those communities, we have an international victims program in partnership with Hiscock Legal Aid, where they provide legal services and we provide advocacy. When you provide the service, you see more victims, but I think the victims were always out there. I think for me, when I think about where we are as a community, any of you who had the opportunity to see the movie Everest when it was at the most, and you almost felt like you had had the opportunity to climb Everest, it was close enough for me. It was very well done. But one of the things, they worked and got their oxygen ready, and finally, after days and days of their efforts, they're at base camp. And so they can look down and say, wow, look at from where we came. But then they have to look up at the peak and know this is where we need to go. So that's been part of my journey in these years, to recognize we've come a long way. I remember when Lucia can recall as a clerk in family court, and the laws that have changed and the capacity of those laws to change people's lives because they have access to orders of protection. Offenders are held accountable so differently than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I meet people who say, you know, I'm 78 years old and I was abused and I lived with this and my mother was abused. There was no Vera House. There was no word for it. There was no place to go. So I know we've come a long way, but I know I'm still looking up at the peak, because when Chauncey talks about keeping them out of the river, that's the peak. So thanks for the question.
You apparently have a number of formal and informal collaborations with other agencies in the community, and I'm wondering, are one of those agencies Planned Parenthood, and if so, what is the relationship you have with the agency?
Well, I was thinking as I look right over your head behind you is Tom McKillen from Arise, one of the agencies we have a wonderful partnership with. I brought some brochures for our Project Emerge, where we're looking to increase accessibility to services for victims with disabilities or victims who are deaf who've experienced sexual assault or domestic violence. We work very closely with Planned Parenthood, I think, in a few ways. One is we have people who may need those services, and so we certainly work hand in hand with our local office. Also, Planned Parenthood of the Syracuse-Rochester region, in the other counties outside of Onondaga, they provide the rape crisis services. So we've just begun to have conversation, had a meeting with Jim Stewart, the CEO, and he's coming back to town with the Director of Rape Crisis Programs for the other counties next month. Betty is an active member of the Human Services Leadership Council, so that we have many opportunities for partnership, conversation, and cross-referral for the services that are needed to the individuals we serve. Thank you.
First of all, thank you for your work, and I love your passion. The person that I worked with when I was in South Carolina, who ran the domestic violence shelters there and programs, had equal passion for the work, and we partnered with them. I don't have a question so much as a comment. It's so critical to be talking about these issues, and especially to give children the opportunity to tell their stories. Our girls had selected domestic violence in South Carolina as the issue around which they wanted to do service within the community. And when they selected that, South Carolina was number one in the country for deaths due to domestic violence. So the girls throughout the year learned about the issue, and they learned about it in an age-appropriate way. It might have been what a healthy relationship means. It might have been about dating. And then for the older girls, the real issue of domestic violence. What ended up happening is they learned about the issue, and then it culminated with them collecting items to bring to shelters. And they walked down the streets of South Carolina to the State House. We had 1,500 girls on the steps of the State House when one girl told her story. We only let girls speak that day. One girl got up there and told her story of when she learned that her father had murdered her mom. She told that story in front of 1,500 people. And she was 6 when this had happened. She was 13 when she told her story. And the reason she told it is that when the Girl Scouts were talking about the issue, it finally gave her permission to acknowledge what had happened to her. And I can't tell you the power of that. Her grandmother told me 2 years later that she had been in counseling from the age of 6, and the counselor could not break through. When the counselor knew the Girl Scouts was addressing the issue, she said to Ryan, maybe now is the time to tell your story. So Ryan did, and it was like a switch went off. She became a completely different person and was able to move on with her life. But up to that point, we and families, I think we have a hard time acknowledging issues that that happened to us. It could be alcoholism. It could be this. But we have to give voice and let people talk about these issues, and that's when I think finally they can move on. So I just can't thank both of you enough for everything you do in this community.
This is a completely different type of question, but 40 years ago, my daughter's first summer assignment at Antioch was with Vera House in New York City. However, that Vera House dealt with people who were in jail. And so I'm curious, where did the name Vera House, what's the history of the word Vera here?
That's a common confusion when I'm traveling and doing things across New York State, because I think you're referring to the Vera Institute of Justice in New York City, which has... They have a great reputation around criminal justice issues and are very, very well known. So when I was first invited to do some statewide work through various organizations, I'd go somewhere and people would say, "You're from Vera?" And I'd think, wow, people before me really made a reputation. And then I'd figure out they weren't talking about Vera House, but I always liked the attention anyway because it got us talking about where the name came from. Sister Mary Vera Blank, who was a nun here in Syracuse at St. Lucie's Parish, she really was the one with the vision who drew together a number of other concerned community members, and that original committee decided to name the house after Sister Mary Vera. I don't know where the Vera Institute of Justice got its name. I've never asked anybody that question. But I think that you'll hear that if you're particularly anywhere near New York City talking about Vera House. So thanks for the question.
Hello. This is outside, I know, your area, but it very much leads to your statement about what's up the river and also walking in their shoes. Up the river are images of women as objects. That is where that starts, that sense of being an adjunct to a male's desires and needs. Walking in those heels is to hobble a woman's individuality and equality. Is there any way that is, I know it's outside of your mission, but is there any way to address that particular societal image that I think is up the river cause for some of the things that happen?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we do actually in alternatives is really when we talk about the way men see women is to stop objectifying them, because I think that's, you know, we see that in our community, we see that on television where women become objects. So the guys who even come to our program, one of the things I make sure they do is when they're talking about their relationships is that it's not, you know, my girlfriend, it's not my baby mama, it's not... She has a name, and let's recognize her as that name. One of the things old lady told me a little while ago, and I've older lady, I will say.
You're doing great.
She told me, she said, make sure that you're always identified as Chauncey. Even if you're in a relationship, you know, and I know we love these sweetheart names and these here, you know, my honey, my darling, all of that. She said, make sure you're always called Chauncey. Because if you're a sweetheart, you're honey, you're all these here, you know, terms of endearment when you're nice and they love you, it's very easy for them to switch over and call you demeaning names when they don't like you. Always be that individual. And so what we try to do is continue to make sure that our men, that conversation we have with men, is that she's always a person. Whatever her name is, that's who she is. She's a person. She's not an object.
She's not someone that you can think about, I'm just going to go sleep with her and do this, do that. She's a person just like you are. So when we start looking at, again, because if I look at a woman as an object, I don't care about objects. I can kick over a television if I have the money. I can push it down. I can do all those things. But when I see Randy as an individual just like I am, then I treat her that way. So I think the mindset and the message has to continue to be, let's make sure that we see everyone as an individual, as a person, not as an object for my usage, for my pleasure, but as a person who wants to be treated just like I want to be treated.
Fred Fisk's publication has helped to publicize a topic that I'm curious about, and that is bullying. Where do you go as far as your way you address bullying, and how wide a scope can you make, and how young do you start talking about it?
I mentioned that we do an education program in the schools, and at different age levels, it's geared slightly differently. The elementary program for the second and fourth graders does include a large bullying component. In fact, there was a national conference several years ago that was entitled From Bullying to Battering, because the children who are bullying other children in the schools grow up to become abusive partners, to commit acts of sexual assault. Bullying, like domestic violence and sexual assault, is about the abuse of power. It's about hurting, humiliating, and putting fear in another. So we absolutely recognize the continuum, and we try to do the work we can. One of the great challenges that we're facing in our communities is that while it's challenging to find funding for the immediate services that are needed, it's 100 times more challenging to find funding for preventive work. Schools are cutting back. Preventive programming dollars are very, very limited, so that we turn away many schools every year who request that type of programming, but who do not have the resources. We do not have the resources, and they do not have the resources within the schools to provide that. So we do the piece we can, and part of this is all about, that's why the community message and engaging the community, to me, is so important. That I know that we at Vera House cannot address the issues of bullying, domestic violence, sexual assault across our community. But if each of you in your world of influence, like the 12 men model, influence 10 people who influence 10, so that you find teachers in schools who maybe can build anti-bullying curriculum even in 10-minute segments to something else they're doing, or when a bullying incident happens, we have to make a cultural shift. We'll keep doing the piece we can. But there aren't resources for an agency to go and address these problems without each of us being part of the solution. But thank you for the question.
And how does workplace violence fit into this whole piece? And what does it look like here in our community?
We've done a little bit about like bullying, violence in the workplace often has a very similar dynamic. Like bullying, we don't have the resources to fully address violence in the workplace, but we often find that a lot of domestic violence in the workplace, a lot of workplace violence is tied to domestic violence in the workplace. Some of the most serious incidents are people who either have attacked a partner at home and then gone to work, or they're trying to find a partner at work. We had our own tragic situation many years ago now at the daycare at the church locally, where somebody came in with a rifle. Young children were there. He was looking for his partner. And if you remember, the community question was, why was she still allowed to work there? And that's part of that changing the question that Chauncey talked about. Really? Do you think she could have stopped him from carrying a rifle in, that she shouldn't be able to work and support her children and family? But we still have a real victim-blaming culture when domestic violence is coming into the workplace. And people think, I don't want a victim here because it's going to mess with my life. It puts me at risk. But that's part of being in the empowered bystander and working together to say, how do we create a safe environment here at work for her? And for all of us, where's our commitment to creating? And that's the piece. I heard somebody speaking recently about how easy it is to speak these words, but how hard it is to actually walk the walk, to be the change we wish to see in the world. A quote that is my favorite, but now is so used that I feel like I'm not supposed to like pink because that's a girly, typical feminine color, and I'm about, but I still like it. I still like that quote. We must be the change we wish to see. So when it challenges us, we've had people who work at Vera House in their own domestic violence situation. So we've had to face that ourselves when people say, oh, my God, well, what if he shows up here? Well, maybe she should work at home. Maybe, and we have to ask ourselves that question about how do we be the change we wish to see, and how do we focus the changes in behavior have to come from the person who's hurting, humiliating, and putting fear in the other, and not from the person who's being hurt. So that's the way I think we can contribute to the dialogue. But again, limited resources to take it to the next level. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Randy. And thank you, Chauncey. And thank you, Vera House, for all that you do.